This is the University of Otago.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Peter Joyce. I'm Dean, University of Otago, Christchurch. And it's my pleasure to introduce the first of our six public health lectures for 2015. With some of our public health lectures, they are also inaugural professorial lectures, which are ancient university traditions that when the university appoint or promote people to professor, they give a lecture on the topic of their research for all to hear. And in Christchurch, we have the tradition of combining it with these public health lectures. So it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Professor Richard Geary, who was promoted by the university. Their decision was made at the end of last year and took effect from the 1st of February this year. And to introduce Richard for both these talks. Now, Richard is a University of Otago graduate and, in fact, did his advanced learning in medicine on the Christchurch campus. And there was an old physician in Christchurch, Barry Coles, who may or may not be known to people from the past, who was renowned for being a stickler for terrifying students. And he said in the first 25 years of the school, Richard was one of the two best medical students who ever trained through Christchurch. And Barry doesn't usually give praise out lightly. So after his training as a physician in Christchurch and a short while in Melbourne, completed a PhD as a registrar, was appointed to our staff in 2007 with a joint appointment with the Canterbury District Health Board as a gastroenterologist. And within a very short period of time, he has been promoted to associate professor and professor, which is thoroughly deserved. So it's my pleasure to introduce Richard tonight to talk about gut instincts, the human GI tract in health and disease. Richard.
Thank you, Peter, for that very kind introduction. When I was asked to give an inaugural professorial lecture, I was obviously felt very very good about that, and it was something I feel quite humble about as well. And I was talking to one of my colleagues, Richard Trout, and he goes, "Oh, what are you going to do for the IPL?" And I thought, IPL, fantastic. Many of you who know me will know that I love cricket. Unfortunately, the cricketing prowess in our family stopped just before it got to my generation, with my father and grandfather being fantastic cricketers. But even though I'm not going to be part of the IPL as you know it, this is the IPL as I know it, and hopefully you'll get some enjoyment tonight. So what I'd like to do is take you on a fantastic voyage through the gastrointestinal tract from one end to the other. And along the way, I want to point out some things of interest. I want this to be a celebration of gut research that goes on in Christchurch. So not just about what I've done, but what other people in our department have done as well. I want to look at some research highlights and find out where we're going to from here. So this is the movie The Fantastic Voyage, starring Raquel Welch, who some of you will know, and Stephen Boyd as well. And in this movie, the spaceship went through the gastrointestinal, it went through the body, firing at aliens and other things along the way. We won't have any firing of guns in here, but hopefully we'll take a trip in a similar way to the people on this voyage. So as a gastroenterologist, it can be interesting when you go to parties and people ask you what you do. And you say you're a gastroenterologist and people think that that's what you do all day. And while that's what I do some of the time, it's certainly not what I do all of the time. And I think as a gastroenterologist and as a group of physicians who work as gastroenterologists, I think we're in a very privileged position. All doctors are in a privileged position in that we get to hear a lot of very intimate details about people. They confide in us, they trust us. And as a gastroenterologist, we hear that, but we also examine them not just on the outside, but on the inside as well. And that ability to do that, I think, means that we have a very close connection with our patients, not just physically, but also in the relationships that we have with them from a therapeutic point of view. And by doing endoscopy, we're able to identify many different diseases from throughout the gastrointestinal tract, be that inflammation, ulceration, dysplasia, neoplasia or cancer, or also worms, as you can see in the bottom there. So to start on our fantastic voyage through the gastrointestinal tract, what I'd like to do is use one of these things here, which is a pill cam or capsule endoscopy. Now the reason I'm going to use that to start with is that this is a new technology, well, not so new now, where you swallow this and it takes photographs as it goes through your gastrointestinal tract. So we can actually go on a voyage through the gastrointestinal tract using one of these and showing the footage. Paul, you're all good at catching, so I'm going to throw that to you and you can pass it around the crowd if you like. Well done. So you'll be pleased to know, Paul, that that isn't one that's been used. Okay, so this is a study of someone swallowing a pill cam. So you can see the people who are watching in the background. There's Dale, a nurse, about to give it to them. And here it goes down. It's in the tongue. It's over the tongue. It's in their mouth. It's going around at the moment. They're having trouble swallowing it. It's quite big. Is it going to go down? Here it goes. Here it goes. There it goes. Down the esophagus, into the stomach. And there it arrives in the stomach there. And this is the sort of technology that we have now with gastroenterology to be able to do that. And in fact, it was the Bowen Liver Trust, which I'll talk about later, that raised the money for the first one of these to be available in a public hospital in New Zealand. So here's the gastrointestinal tract. This is my part of the world when I come to work. This is what I do. And we're going to start up at the top with the esophagus, which is how we get food from our mouth to our stomach. It's the highway for getting things in. And essentially there are these peristaltic waves of contraction that push food and fluid down the esophagus into the stomach. And many of you may be aware of the illnesses that can affect the esophagus, such as gastroesophageal reflux disease or esophageal cancer. And reflux is really very, very common. And as we all get a bit bigger around here, myself included, more pressure is being put on our stomach, pushing the contents back up into the esophagus and causing this burning, or when we might overeat or overindulge. And certainly the ability to treat this now with medications and surgery has improved over the years. Moving on quickly from the esophagus, we have the stomach here, and I think the stomach's a fantastic organ. It's a liquidizer. So you know your food processor, the bit you put on top, and you push the button and buzz it. It takes the solid food and fluid and churns that up together to make this lovely stuff that's left that's called chyme. And that's what leaves your stomach and goes into the rest of your gastrointestinal tract. So the stomach is a great big liquidizer. And the sorts of diseases that can affect the stomach include peptic ulcer disease or stomach ulcers, which are often caused by Helicobacter pylori, and gastric cancer. And here we can see Warren and Marshall. You'll see them doing a high five. I think it's slightly better than the high five that Richie McCaw and Stephen Fleming missed on the opening night of the World Cup. But they were doing that because they won the Nobel Prize for discovering, by infecting themselves with this bacteria, that it actually causes stomach ulcers. And by doing that, they were able to then come up with treatments for stomach ulcers that allowed people to essentially survive when they presented very unwell and prevented that happening. And we've got local researchers, including Dr. Jackie Keenan, who have done tremendous work on Helicobacter pylori, and Jackie has also done great work in the way that bugs in the gut interact with the gastrointestinal system. We're going to talk a lot about that tonight. So you might ask, well, how do you look at the gastrointestinal system? How do you do your job? So just to make it a little bit more obvious about what we do, I thought I'd bring along a scope. And certainly you're all welcome at the end to come and play with this if you want. I have washed it, so it is a clean one. And you can see here that by using this sort of instrument, we're able to steer and look around by moving up and down, left and right. And we can put biopsy forceps and other things through the scope to enable us to take biopsies and do other things as well. So this is old gastroenterology technology, if you like, but something that we use on a routine basis. This is a gastric ulcer. I'm going to show you this movie. We're very lucky on the net. If you want to ever look at an endoscopic image of something, Dr. Murrah from El Salvador has put just about every endoscopy he's ever done online. So you can see someone with this enormous gastric ulcer, for example, which could easily bleed large amounts of blood into the gastrointestinal tract, or it could burrow through the wall of the bowel and perforate, causing problems as well. And Dr. Murrah is very brave, putting his scope quite so far into the ulcer. I'm not sure many of the local gastroenterologists would do that, but he wanted to get the right shot, and he was able to do that quite easily by doing that. So that's gastrointestinal ulcers. And how do we treat that sort of thing? Well, we can inject it by putting adrenaline in around that if it's bleeding, or we can even put clips through the scope and clip a blood vessel on the end, which enables us to stop bleeding and improve outcomes for patients. So moving on from the stomach to probably my favourite organ in the body, just my favourite organ, that's the small intestine, which I think is really a wonderful thing. It's where digestion happens. It's where that food that you had for lunch, for dinner, what you've had to drink, finally gets absorbed into the body and has an effect on people. Interestingly, 9 litres a day of fluid are secreted into the small bowel to enable you to do that. So it's a very complex environment of what's going on there. And the sorts of diseases that can affect people in the small intestine include celiac disease and Crohn's disease. So celiac disease, many of you will be aware of, is to do with gluten. And interestingly, the small bowel was normally 20 feet long approximately, but it's got a surface area the size of a tennis court. And that's because of these microvilli and these villi which project like this, increasing the surface area, allowing food to be absorbed and nutrients to be absorbed into the intestine. But in celiac disease, you'll see that these long villi that are here have now gone, and you're left with this flattened mucosa and these long crypts, meaning that food can't be absorbed as well, and people can often have symptoms. And these symptoms can include diarrhea, pain and bloating, but some people have no symptoms whatsoever, but still can get complications. In Christchurch, there's been research done suggesting about 1 in 85 or so people have celiac disease. And that was one of the first studies that really made it clear how common celiac disease was. And they did this study by taking random people who were allowed, who wanted to come in, selected off the electoral roll, and for free they got testing for a number of things done. And we came up with the background rates of how common these diseases were. And some of the people who were involved in that research in particular, and celiac disease in particular, is Dr. Cook, Bramwell Cook, who's been retired for a while now. You can read about Bramwell in the newsletter that's in front of you there, about how he's a trustee as well. And also Andrew Day, I think, has done some really interesting work on celiac disease in the paediatric population. If you want to know more about celiac disease, there's people from the Celiac Society outside today, and they can give you some more information as well. So before we get on to my second favourite organ, I have to talk about the liver, because my colleagues do tell me that it is part of the gastrointestinal tract, even though I tend not to look after people with problems from that organ quite so often. The liver, they tell me, is important, and I do believe them. It is a very important organ in the body. And it can be affected by many different diseases, as you can see here, that affect people in different ways. And in Christchurch, we've been, I think, blessed with an amazing group of liver researchers. And I think they've gone under the radar in many ways. Their outputs have been amazing. We've got Robin Fraser, who is well known for his work on the liver sieve and really internationally renowned for that. Bruce Chapman, not just with hepatitis, but many other liver diseases and diseases as well. Jeffrey New at the top there, who's recently done a PhD and has been headhunted over to Singapore, where he's working at the moment. Michael Burt, done great work on hemochromatosis while he was overseas. And Catherine Stedman, who amazingly has just been involved in new treatments to cure hepatitis C. And again, if you want to read about that in more detail, it's in the newsletter in front of you. Liver disease is a big deal, because if you don't catch liver disease early, it can progress to cirrhosis, and you can see this nodular liver on the right. And the complications of cirrhosis include liver cancer and also liver failure. And while liver transplant is an option, there aren't many livers about. There's a shortage, and people die on the waiting list waiting for liver transplant, and some people aren't suitable. The pancreas is also important as well, and just to mention two great researchers locally, Saxon Connor and Madhiv Bhatia, who work in that area as well. So there's a great depth of gut research going on in Christchurch. So now we can move on to my second favourite organ in the body, the colon. I knew you were waiting for this bit. It's the exciting bit. So this is where absorption of water and salts occur. And your colon's really important, because it allows you to actually not have to do a poo every 2 minutes. You can actually delay having a poo, which means that you can get on and do other things in your life that are as important as that. The sorts of diseases that affect the colon can include ulcerative colitis, colorectal cancer, and diverticular disease. These are polyps, which some of you may have heard of. And as a gastroenterologist, there are many things that make us happy in life, but finding polyps is one of the true joys that we have. Because if we find a polyp, we can remove it. And if we remove it, we may be able to prevent bowel cancer. And again, that makes us very happy and content in our jobs and enjoy life. As you can see here, there's this thing called the polyp cancer sequence, where people start with a polyp and end up having cancer further down the track. So if we can intervene back here and remove the polyps, then maybe we can prevent cancer. And here you can see how we can use a snare over the top of a polyp to remove it from the bowel. And that prevents bowel cancer, which is what's going on here. The way we do that is with colonoscopy, which is very similar to this instrument here, but you'll be pleased to know it's a different instrument. We don't use the same one for both things. Bowel cancer is a really big deal in New Zealand, a really big deal. And you can see here that the rate of bowel cancer increases with age. And over 2,500 people are diagnosed each year. About 50 people are diagnosed each week in New Zealand with bowel cancer. And while we really enjoy beating Australia at rugby union, rugby league, cricket this weekend, it's not so good to beat them when it comes to the frequency of bowel cancer and the mortality from bowel cancer. I'm very happy to let them win that one. And we need to do more about this. We need to have more knowledge about what's going on. We need to be able to have better methods of detecting bowel cancer easily, perhaps not with colonoscopy, but perhaps with other things by doing that. And in Christchurch, again, there are many researchers who are working on bowel cancer. Jackie again, Chris Wakeman, Tim Eggington, Frank Frizzell, people in the cancer group who work together to work on bowel cancer. So getting back to life as a gastroenterologist and some of the things that I do endoscopy, but I do other things as well. But I must say, while we like finding polyps, it also puts a spring in our step and joy in our heart to see a normal colon. This is a normal colon. You can see it's healthy. You can see the capillaries across the wall of the bowel, that glistening appearance. It's a beautiful thing, ladies and gentlemen, a beautiful thing. It's also beautiful when there's a lovely prep like this, as opposed to a poor bowel prep when we get to see lots of other things as well. But the gut is an amazing part of the body, and the colon's an amazing part of the body because it is by far the most complex of organs. And I'm sure that every specialist will tell you that their area is the most important, but you can rest assured that I'm right. People say the heart's important, the brain's complex, but really, where else are there trillions and trillions of single organisms that are bacteria living inside us in harmony with our body, interacting in a way that's quite natural? We are more bug than human, and the way in which that interaction between bugs and humans works together is, of course, very important. So when things go wrong, such as with ulcerative colitis, and here's someone with severe ulcerative colitis, you can see how someone with a gut like this could easily end up with bleeding from the bowel, with diarrhea, with weight loss, and be very unwell. And obviously this is something that we need to get under control. And likewise, when we see people with Crohn's disease, which is more of a patchy inflammation, where there's inflammation in some parts of the bowel but not others, we can see here that there's a stricture in this part of the bowel just here, narrowing, that again, people can be very unwell with this, and this is Crohn's disease. So Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are inflammatory bowel diseases, IBD, and that's what I've spent a lot of my time doing research into and what I'm going to speak about for a lot of what's to come. So here you can see a normal colon, the cartoon. We can see a normal colon with regards to the endoscopic findings and the biopsies, but for Crohn's disease, that inflammation, and for ulcerative colitis as well. And these are diseases that don't have a cure. So once you're diagnosed, it's something you always have. At the moment, we don't have a cure. So our aim of treatment is trying to get people into remission, trying to control their symptoms using a variety of different things. So this is a slide that I put up often, and this was a slide that motivated me to do research because it was put out by the American Gastroenterological Association in their slide set showing how common IBD, or inflammatory bowel disease, was around the world. And I was really impressed about one thing and really unimpressed about the other. I was impressed that they didn't cut the map off here like they usually do, because most maps of the world, they cut New Zealand off and we don't exist. So that was good. But I was really unimpressed by the data that suggested we had very little inflammatory bowel disease locally, when the reality in clinic was our clinics were full of patients with Crohn's and colitis, and it just didn't add up really as far as I was concerned. So because of that, we embarked on the Canterbury IBD project, where as part of my PhD, I tried to find everyone in Canterbury with IBD, and I probably may have found some of the people in this room, back between 2004 and 2006. And from those people, we collected an enormous amount of data. And there were 1,420 patients in all, and that data has enabled us to do a lot of research subsequently. So these were the worldwide data for the number of new diagnoses of ulcerative colitis in various places around the world. So down to here, Cardiff, you can see all these areas in the Northern Hemisphere, an increase over the years. So how would we stack up in New Zealand against that? Well, here's the data for ulcerative colitis. So this is data here for Canada, here for Geelong in Australia, here is where we were for Christchurch, and you can see here, wham. This is data from last year, so data that we presented, done by Heidi Sue and Vikesh Gupta, a summer student, looking at this increase in ulcerative colitis. So in 10 years, we've doubled the number of new diagnoses, and that is standardised per 100,000. So it's not the fact the population's gone up. These are new diagnoses and a very real increase. And likewise, for Crohn's disease, it's increased all around the world in what we're seeing. Here in Canada, very high rates, everyone got very excited. We did our data and also found high rates, roughly equivalent to that. There's some data from Geelong in Australia, where I helped out with that study. From Nelson, we'd looked at that previously. Last year in Canterbury, wham, up it goes again by 50%. And there are many, many reasons why this could be, and we'll discuss some of them and what's coming up. And I'm sure many people in the room will have ideas as to why this is as well. But this is a real finding. These are real new cases of Crohn's disease. And remember, there's no cure. So once you're diagnosed, you have it for life. So this is a lifelong disease. So who are these people? Well, in the blue, you can see the data from 2004. So this is the age of people who are diagnosed. So the five-year age groups are on the bottom. And then the number of new diagnoses up here. So the blue bars are the data from 2004. And in the red, we can see the data from 2014, showing that the increase in rates is across the board in all age groups. But it's particularly affecting people in this part of life here, which is when people are younger, when they're going to university, when they're forming relationships, when they're having children, all of those things which are really important parts of people's lives, times in people's lives, that they're getting affected by these diseases. And what we need to do is understand why that is a little bit better. So why so much IBD? I don't plan to answer that tonight because I don't have the answer, but I want to give you some ideas and some hints from research that we've done to date. So I'll ask you this question: why is a healthy gut like the Dalai Lama? Well, if we look at the gastrointestinal tract and we pretend this is the intestine here and then this is the body here, in the gut we have billions and billions and billions of bacteria that live there and they interact with our immune system. And if those bacteria were anywhere else in your body, there'd be a rampaging infection. There'd be inflammation going on and all sorts of problems. So like the Dalai Lama, in health, the human gut is tolerant. It doesn't matter what's going on, it's tolerant, it doesn't mind. But in inflammatory bowel disease, it's not so flash. All of a sudden, the IBD gut becomes like Paul Henry. And you can imagine where this is going. You've got the intestine full of bacteria, all these problems going on, this interaction with the immune system, but you've got no tolerance. And this is what's going on, is that immune system's turning back on the body, turning back on the bacteria in the gut. And what's left, what's caught in the middle between the immune system and the bacteria? The gut. And that's what gets hammered by that inflammation and why this is going on and what causes the symptoms that come subsequently. So I find these Venn diagrams sort of helpful but unhelpful, because if it was this simple, we'd know all the answers and we'd go home, there'd be nothing to do. But in broad terms, we know that there is a genetic susceptibility to Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. But it's not black and white, it's not blue eyes and brown eyes, it's much more complicated than that. We know there are environmental triggers where there are factors that we're exposed to that may trigger off Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis in people, and then there's the host's immune response. So people often ask me, is IBD a genetic disease? Well, having a family history is a strong risk factor, but most people don't have one. And what it is that many of the genes that are involved just increase your risk 2 or 3% here, 2 or 3% here, and it's probably an additive effect plus the environment on top that eventually triggers you over the threshold to develop inflammatory bowel disease. Here we can see a cartoon showing the gut at the top here, and these are the cells of the gut, and these are the immune cells. And around the outside are the many genes that have been identified to be included with inflammatory bowel disease. Now, genetics is really complicated. I'm not going to go through genes in detail tonight, but just to show you that in collaboration with people like Rebecca Roberts and Martin Kennedy, we're able to identify many of those genes through work done locally in inflammatory bowel disease. And that's led to some marked discoveries. And what it does, if you identify genes that might be involved in a disease, all of a sudden it opens up the thought that perhaps this pathway is important in disease, so perhaps we can develop a drug that will block that. So that's where a gene discovery, a very basic science discovery, can lead to a translational result further down the track. And that's why basic science is so important to translational research later on. So what else is going on? Well, in the old days, the very old days, when we were cavemen with torches and etc., life was very different. We lived in a pretty dirty environment. I'm not saying dirty in a negative way, but dirty in a positive way. There were bacteria everywhere. There were chronic infections. There was no refrigeration. We ate food that had been lying out for a while. All these things were very different to nowadays, where we live in a very hygienic and clean society. And certainly it's thought that because we're exposed to fewer bacteria now than we used to, maybe that changes the way that our immune system interacts with the bacteria that are there. And maybe that could be something that changes the way in which all of a sudden inflammation is driven when we don't have this wide repertoire of infective stimuli going on in our gut. So one of the big steps that came forward from genetics was consortia, where groups from around the world combined their information or their data to work out some of the really big questions in disease. And inflammatory bowel disease is one of the really good examples where many groups from all around the world were able to combine their data to come up with some really important answers. And this is a paper that was in Nature from 2 or 3 years ago that I was very lucky to be involved in. And to be honest, I don't understand a lot of it because the amount of mathematics in this is unbelievable. And while I didn't mind mathematics at school, I liked biology a lot more. And this was a real struggle for me. But essentially, they were able to combine the results of 37,000 IBD patients' DNA and what we call a genome-wide association study, and then meta-analyse that with other things. And I think it was really a triumph in mathematics, because the numbers that you're talking here, considering the number of base pairs in the genome, is just incredible. And what we're able to do is identify 163 genes that clearly were associated with inflammatory bowel disease, and then we'd look out where those genes were involved in biology, and that would help us understand exactly what was going on. And certainly, even by doing this, we still don't understand a lot about the genetics of inflammatory bowel disease. And this is an idea of the complexity of the way in which these genes interact. But I just want to take you through one slide, or a couple of slides here, just to bring out a really important point that's come out from the study. So this purple dot here in the middle represents the IBD genes. These genes here are genes associated with immune-mediated diseases. Here, diseases are genes associated with getting TB, that predispose you to getting TB, and genes that predispose you with leprosy. And you might say, well, how does all this fit together? You know, infections and immune diseases. Well, one of the questions that this has raised, and it goes right back to Darwin, who's sitting there at the bottom of the page, is in the infectious age, people were dying all the time from chronic infections, TB, you name it, people were dropping over all the time. And if one was to develop a mutation in your immune system that enabled you to be resistant to some of these things, that would give you an enormous survival advantage over other people in your who were living at the same time. And it's likely that some of these genes were selected for that gave protection against some of these bacteria. But then, of course, as life goes on and then all of a sudden we change and we're in an environment that's cleaner with lots of antibiotics around and we can treat all these infections now, then all of a sudden those genes aren't so useful anymore. And in fact, maybe those genes in an environment that changes and becomes a lot cleaner could in fact start predisposing to an autoimmune disease where the body's immune system is attacking bacteria that are supposed to be friendly to us. So that's what this sort of large study does, is brings up these very large ideas that we can then drill down on to find out a lot more about what's going on. But the environment's really where it's at, because if you get this rapid increase in the incidence of a new disease, you have to wonder, why is that? Why all of a sudden are we getting more and more people? The genes in the overall population will remain the same, just be shuffled in different ways for different people. But what's come in with the environment that's really making a difference to what's going on? So someone's once said, genes load the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. What are these triggers that are going on? So to do this, we looked at this in a case control study where we took people with inflammatory bowel disease and people without inflammatory bowel disease who were matched for age and sex, and then we looked at different things in each group to see whether there was an association between disease and not disease. And here we can see what these factors were, and this column here is the one to focus on. If the number is greater than one, the risk is increased. If it's less than one, it's decreased. And what you can see, a family history does increase your risk. It doesn't mean that you're going to get it 100%, but it does increase your risk. Smoking increases your risk of Crohn's disease. Interestingly, decreases your risk of ulcerative colitis. But then when you stop smoking, you are more likely to get ulcerative colitis, which is a paradox we don't understand very well. And again, for novel risk factors that we looked at, mothers who smoked during pregnancy, their children had an increased risk of developing Crohn's disease. Not a huge increase, but a small increase. Antibiotic use also appeared to be associated with an increased risk. And this one we can't understand very well, but having a vegetable garden in your property reduced your risk of getting Crohn's disease. It's probably something to do with either being out in the dirt playing, perhaps it's a dietary thing that people with a vegetable garden tend to have different diets. We can't explain it that much, but these give little clues as to what might be going on. This information I think was very interesting because there's a lot of debate as to whether breastfeeding might be protective So if you were breastfed, maybe you're less likely to get Crohn's. And some people thought that, other people didn't. So we thought we'd tease that apart a bit more, and we looked at how long people were breastfed for. We've got a wonderful thing in New Zealand called the Royal New Zealand Plunket Society. And in your book, which many of you probably still have access to, it'll tell you how long you were breastfed to. So we had quite good data on that. And what we found that was breastfeeding was good, but it had to be for 3 months or longer. And you might hypothesise that the reason for that is that people who are breastfed have different bugs in their gut to people who are bottle fed. And it may well be that that those different bacteria, maybe probiotics or different bacteria that are there, are more able to lead to a healthier gut in those who are breastfed. And saying that, I've still known lots of patients who are breastfed for more than 12 months who have got Crohn's disease. These aren't absolute things, but they give us a clue as to what might be going on. Okay, fecal microbiota. So when it comes down to it, what's in our gut is very, very important. And it really is the final frontier when it comes to going on with health. And I say that not just with regards to inflammatory bowel disease, but Ginny Willis is in the front row, and I think Renee Wilson's here as well. At the moment, we're doing a project looking at gut microflora in diabetes, because we think that gut microflora has got much more to do than just about gut health. But in fact, it's probably got things to do with obesity, diabetes, all sorts of diseases. It all starts in the gut. I told you it was important. No one's been listening, but I told you it is very, very important. And I think the University of Otago is very well positioned for doing research in this area, and certainly we're collaborating widely and trying to tease this apart. And a good example of this is some work here by Catherine Moore, who's another PhD student working with us. Both Renee and Catherine are dietitians. And we're feeding people with Crohn's disease exclusive enteral nutrition. So that means you get formula fed, but no food for 2 weeks. We'll give you enough formula that it's all you need for complete nutritional capacity, if you like. And here we can see on the left a patient, and these are each of the bars is at baseline, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and afterwards, and these are different bacteria. And what you can see, this patient got better with exclusive enteral nutrition, and they had sustained changes in these bacteria over time. And what that makes us think is, can we modulate the bacteria that live in our gut by what we eat? And can that therefore change inflammation or change other things that are going on? And on the other side, you can see here someone who didn't get better, and their data are all over the place. So maybe in that person, we're not able to have the same effect because we can't change the gut flora in the same way. And these are the new ways that we're starting to think about how we might better manage people with different diseases. We've done some work with Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis as well. These are little microbes that have been associated with Crohn's disease, but the treatment trials have been negative, although we're about to start a new treatment trial quite soon in that area. I couldn't give a talk without talking about fecal transplant, because as a gastroenterologist, that's probably the most common question I'm asked about is, is fecal transplant something that's going to make you better? And for many things in life, I think it's better to give than receive, and I think that for fecal transplant, that's probably another very good example. And while Michael K. Hurst had a fantastic result from taking someone else's faeces, mixing it up and injecting it into his own colon, there are no randomised trials that suggest that for inflammatory bowel disease, that's an effective therapy. So therefore, as a clinician and as a scientist, I can't, even though patients ask me about it, it's something I can't say we should do until there are some trials that do it. And I think we need to find some PhD students or other people who want to take that part over, because I'm not so sure I want to be involved in it. But it's a fascinating concept. Why not just change all of your gut flora by putting someone, a donor's faeces in and changing all of those bacteria? But again, personally, I'd rather wait for some data to know that it was worthwhile before rushing in and doing it to myself or my patients. So inflammation is what's behind inflammatory bowel disease, and it's very important. It's what the crux of it is, and also tells us about biomarkers, potentially, because if we could find out about markers in the gut and the faeces that told us what was going on, then perhaps we need to do less of this. And while I love doing this, my patients don't always share my enthusiasm for it. So if we could come up with other ways of identifying what's going on in the gut by looking in the faeces for measuring things, then that would be a real advantage. And certainly over time, we know that in inflammatory bowel disease, we have these flares of disease. And with each flare of disease, the gut gets damaged. And this damage may be irreversible. So if we can identify inflammation more easily, we can treat it more aggressively and maybe lead to better outcomes. Here we can see some work by Nick Magon looking at calprotectin and looking at modifications of this. This work's done with Mark Hampton and Tony Kettle in the Free Radical Research Group here in the School of Medicine, three floors up from here. And they are able to identify proteins in body fluids that reflect inflammation, and this modified calprotectin, I think, has got a lot of promise. We've also got data here from looking with Andrew Day, Rob Lopez and Anna Ashcroft, looking at S100A12, and what you can see as we go across the slide is here are controls with no inflammation, here are people with severe Crohn's disease. So there's this trend of increasing concentrations of these proteins in the faeces. And once we can understand where the cutoffs are and whether we can be accurately predict it, we can translate that into clinical practice. And where we've been able to do that recently is in a study called the POCUS study, which is an Australian and New Zealand study. And don't worry about the details on here. I'll take you through them in a minute. But we found patients who needed to have part of their bowel cut out for Crohn's disease. But what we know is that when the bowel's joined back together, the Crohn's comes back at the joint quite often. And we need to know that, because if the inflammation's come back, then we need to treat people more aggressively. But if it hasn't come back, then we can be relaxed and not worry about it so much. But that would mean a colonoscopy for that patient all the time. So as part of the study, we measured calprotectin in the faeces of these people. And what we were able to find was that with 90% accuracy, we could predict whether there was inflammation back at that joint or not. And that's recently been accepted to gastroenterology, and the main paper's also gone into the Lancet. So these are major findings that we're able to do, and that research was done locally here, local patients taking part in that research and combining with other centres in Australia as well. It's hard to talk about the gut without talking about the brain, and certainly the gut-brain axis is something that many people recognise, that the way things are going on in your brain can affect your gut and vice versa. And I often give the example to patients where I'll say to them, you'll remember before school cert that half your class rushed off to the toilet, half went to cheat and write things on their hands, and the other half went to have diarrhoea because they were so nervous. And this connection between the gut and the brain is present on many different levels, and I don't have time to explore that fully tonight, but I'll just draw attention to Andrew McCombie, Dr. Andrew McCombie, who recently graduated with his PhD. Roger Mulder and I supervised him, and he looked at how people cope with disease, with inflammatory bowel disease, and developed, with help from some Australian collaborators, an online tool where patients could go through a program learning how to manage stress and other anxieties in a better way, leading to better outcomes. And he's currently in Barcelona presenting that research, although I'd much rather be here in Christchurch presenting to you than in Barcelona. I'm just going to finish by talking about the diet and gut, because again, there are various things that occur to you in your practicing career as a doctor where someone says something to you, a patient, you think, you know, they're right, but I can't give them an answer. I know they've hit the nail on the head, but I can't quite work out where I'm going to take that. I still remember a patient saying to me, what are you going on about? The gut's a food machine. Clearly that's where the answer's got to be. And I just still remember that. It was about 12 years ago. It's in the back of my mind. I've always thought if we can understand that interaction between diet and the gut, it's going to take us a long way towards understanding how disease works as well. So some of the things I've been involved with in the past include intestinal failure. So what happens when you run out of gut? So if you have lots of operations and there's not enough gut left, or if the gut doesn't work properly, and certainly we can put tubes in through the nose, and we can put PEG tubes in through the skin into the stomach, and we can also feed people through a formula directly into a vein, completely bypassing the gut altogether. But that's got a lot of risk associated with it and a lot of potential problems as well. And we don't have to do that very often, but there are some places in the world where they do that a lot. In St Mark's Hospital in London, I was lucky to go there for 3 months, and I looked at, they've got a big intestinal failure unit there that treats a lot of people from all around the United Kingdom. And what we found was that in the patients that were there, there were two major reasons for why patients got intestinal failure. Aggressive Crohn's disease, and that brought home to me why we have to treat Crohn's disease aggressively, and also lots of surgical complications. And certainly those surgical complications are things that sometimes happen, but I'm certainly very happy here with the very high quality of colorectal surgeons that we have in Canterbury that really provide very good support for our IBD patients who need to have surgery. The other thing I'm interested in leaving IBD behind for a while is IBS, and this is irritable bowel syndrome, which is really common. So 1 in 6 women, 1 in 9 men have got irritable bowel syndrome. The gut looks completely normal, so that gives me the happy smiley face, the nice gut with the capillaries on that you can see. But people get bloating and pain and wind and diarrhea and constipation. And it used to be very frustrating for us because very clearly patients were unwell, but everything looked normal. And obviously that was fine, but actually these people had real symptoms, and actually had real effects on their quality of life. So certainly I was very lucky, and I'll talk a little bit about low FODMAP diet because I was involved in some of that work in Australia. But I've also been doing work with kiwifruit on Zespri and kiwifruit extracts with a company called Anagenix, looking at ways of improving particularly constipation. As we all know, kiwifruit are good to keep you going. So certainly we're always on the lookout for patients who can help with those studies. But when it comes to FODMAPs, FODMAP is much easier to say than fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides and polyols. So we'll just say FODMAP. But essentially this whole concept of FODMAPs came about through Peter Gibson, who's there on top there, and Sue Shepherd, who's a dietitian. Peter Gibson's a gastroenterologist who works in Melbourne, and Sue's a dietitian. And this came about through clinical observation. If there are students in the audience, you're obviously the really keen ones to be here this late. But you know, simple clinical observations of what was going on, trial and error, coming up with a hypothesis and testing it. It's really how this came about. So FODMAPs, oligosaccharides, these are fructans, galactans. So they're found in beans, onions, windy sort of vegetables, you get the drift. Also, they're found wherever you find gluten, which is why many people will go on a gluten-free diet and feel better. Not because of the gluten, probably. There's not much data to support gluten causing problems outside of celiac disease, but more to do with the fructans that are found where you find gluten. Lactose in some people can cause problems, but not in everyone. Fructose in some people can cause problems, apples and pears in particular, lots of fructose in those. And polyols are also very important. And you probably used to think that it was karma, which was the reason why when you went over to the neighbours and stole their apricots and had a big feed of them that you got diarrhoea afterwards. Well, it wasn't karma, it was sorbitol that was actually doing that and causing that diarrhoea as it came through as a FODMAP and causing those symptoms. So all of those things cause problems because they're osmotically active in the bowel. They pull fluid into the bowel and they're fermented, so they get fermentation going on, stretching the bowel, causing wind. I can feel you getting more and more bloated as I'm talking about this. And that stretches the gut, causes pain, causes wind, causes diarrhea and causes symptoms. And the bowel looks normal, but the gut's very sensitive in people with irritable bowel syndrome, and that's why they get these symptoms. And if we're going to put that in a cartoon with a small bowel on the left, the large bowel on the right, the FODMAPs go through the small bowel, bringing fluid into the bowel, delivering that fluid to the colon, stretching the bowel, producing that fluid, increasing gas fluid, causing those symptoms. And while it's interesting nutrition, I think in nutrition there are lots of theories without much evidence, but in fact, when it comes to low FODMAP diet, there's an enormous amount of evidence. And they've done studies in patients with an ileostomy where they give them a high FODMAP diet and a low FODMAP diet, and those with a high FODMAP diet have a 20% increase in their stoma output. So you can measure these things, and that's been done. And we were also lucky to have a Dutch student come over, Reinout, who looked at our practice locally and found that we get very similar response rates in these groups of patients. So I think this has been a real game changer, the low FODMAP diet, and I feel very privileged to have been involved in it because of the year I spent in Melbourne with Peter and Sue, where we did a lot of this work. So I'll wrap up just now, but the gut is a wonderful thing. You know, you're all here because you clearly believe so I'm preaching to the converted, but it is an amazing organ, and it's got an amazing interactions with the bacteria that live within it, with the immune system, with many other parts and things that are around. Gut disease in Canterbury and around the world, is, but especially in Canterbury, is more common than you think, and we need to talk about it. So if you have symptoms, you need to go and see your doctor. You don't need to wait 2 years and find out that actually you had something that was quite treatable, but it's too late. Gut research is really important for gut health, and a large amount of the research that I've alluded to tonight, not just my own research, but research carried out by others locally, has been funded locally by the Bowel and Liver Trust and by other organisations as well. And if that research isn't funded, it doesn't happen, and that's very, very important. And if you've got a healthy gut, you've got a happy, healthy life. And I think that often there's a lot of anecdotes and a lot of sayings that reflect how gut health reflects a healthy life as well. And certainly a collaborative approach is the key to success in working together. Now, this is an IPL, not the IPL in India, but an inaugural professorial lecture. And while that sort of means it is a little bit about me, I don't work in isolation. And I've got no apologies for the number of acknowledgements I'm about to go through, because each and every one of them are very important. Firstly, my research students, these are the people that do all the hard work. These are the people that have to deal with the problems that I can just talk about abstractly, and then they have to actually go and sort them out. And I'm very grateful for the very hard work that many of them have done over many years. We've had an amazing selection of summer students. These are students who spend 10 weeks with us doing a very small project. And that's gone from Andrew Dodgson back in 2003 all the way through to Vikesh just now, who was involved in that study that showed such a high rate of inflammatory bowel disease in Canterbury. We've had some amazing research students from around the world join us for short periods of time, particularly from the VU University in Amsterdam. And I was over there recently at a conference and had a dinner with this group of students, and they're amazing people who come in with a great outlook on life. And Floris is here tonight. He's about to start on Monday, so no pressure, no pressure at all. We had some fantastic registrars and house surgeons who have helped with research, and research isn't for everyone, but certainly a lot of people have done some great work, and I'm very grateful to them. Then there's everyone else, and I had to stop because it would have been illegible, and I'm going to leave it up there for a while, but there are people from all around the world and from locally who have done amazing things to support gut research, and those people, I think, have to be acknowledged for what they do. A lot of it they do out of goodwill, and certainly I'm very, very grateful. And as I mentioned before, it doesn't happen unless there's some money to pay for it. Those students who do a PhD, they take 3 years off from medical studies or medical careers to do that work, and they need to be fed, you know, not much, but something. So getting money to pay their stipends, getting money to pay for their consumables is so important. And again, the Bell and Liver Trust, which you'll read about a lot in the magazine that you've got in front of you, is one of the major contributors to research locally. There's a few academic mentors I'd like to mention specifically. The first is Mark Burrows, who isn't on here. The reason he's not on here is that I cannot find a photo of him anywhere. I rang every M. Burrows in the phone book in Christchurch, and none of them know who he is. I don't know where he is, but he was my teacher at St. Martin's Primary School. Truly inspirational person who really got me going. Graham Warner is my biology teacher. He's here tonight. I'm very grateful for him as well. And all the encouragement and interest he got me into biology with as well. Bruce and Michael in the department really have done a lot, I think, to help me over the years. Bruce, the most amazing inquiring mind you'll ever meet, someone who won't take no for an answer, will follow through something right to the very end. And for Michael, for his pragmatism and just getting the job done. And Peter Gibson as well in Australia, who has been very supportive. I'm very grateful to my family, my mother and father, Roy and Denise, for all the support they've given me, and for my brother Andrew for inspiration. And my wife Justine and the children for putting up with me having to work hard. All right, sorry, I wasn't supposed to do that. I just want to finish with this picture, which is part of a photo essay which one of my patients put together. His name is Sam Sword, and he had Crohn's disease, and he had it quite badly. He was in hospital a lot, and he put together he got a model to essentially take photographs of different things and the way in which his experience of disease was like. And at the end of the day, it all comes back to our patients. If we're doctors, how our patients are, what they experience, and how we can help them. And I think that we need to acknowledge that and recognise that really the patients are where we come from when it comes to clinical research. But bringing that basic research through becomes very important. Thanks very much.